The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Salnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Well, welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show Q&A edition for this week. Still got Jim remote from the hot and sweaty Florida this week. They're in the midst of that heat wave still as we're recording this. So I'm in the frigid Colorado zone, which a lot of people in this area of the country are pretty cold right now. And apparently Southern California is getting dumped on with snow. So all kinds of weird stuff going on here. But we're forging ahead with the Q&A show. He's been going through. He warned me we've got at least one Social Security question today, and then we've got some follow-up fun number questions, as we're getting fun number questions based on our EDU shows that we did over the past several weeks, focusing on that concept that's part of our approach to retirement planning. But I want to thank everybody for joining us today, who's listening in, and I'll bring Jim on, and we can dive in whenever he's ready.
Well, good morning, Chris. Actually, afternoon for me, but morning for you.
Yeah, I'm still morning here. Yeah, supposed to warm up a little today here, but
so you guys are going to hit about 30 today. It's going to get in the. It's already in the 80s here. It's just it's humid for me. It's humid. I'm not used to the humidity. I go on a short 4 mile walk every day. Although today I kind of jogged a little of it. I haven't jogged for years since I severed my ACL way back when I was a cop. But I thought today I'm going to try jogging a little. But it is hot.
What possessed you to do that in that heat and humidity?
Well,
just see if you could do it.
I don't want to spend 3 weeks in Florida doing nothing and then go home to Colorado, throw a backpack on, and try hiking or snowshoeing again. So I'm trying to keep into some reasonable shape and get used to humidity, especially if I relocate to Ohio River Valley, either on the Kentucky or Ohio side. But they have humidity there, unlike Colorado. Oh, so just try to get used to it. Saw a little baby alligator today. It was out near the whole development I'm in have lakes everywhere, little ponds, but they're all man-made. And they're all the houses are around a lake, and then the lakes get full of alligators. But there was a little baby one near the shore, which is the perfect size to see, about an 18-inch alligator, maybe a 2-foot alligator. I don't really get close enough to measure it. You don't really want to see the 15-foot alligator varieties.
I've never heard. Do alligators protect their young like bears do? Because like when we're hiking around in Colorado, if you see a baby bear,
you get the hell out of it.
Exactly, because that's you're a target at that point from the mother. So
I did want to get close enough to the shore to see said baby alligator, just in case mom was nearby and didn't want me near her little baby. But it was interesting to see a small one. I've seen the larger ones too. It's kind of weird seeing these prehistoric creatures dancing around. But anyways, that was my little excitement on today's walk/jog. besides sweating. And I kept thinking of you. I was like, oh my God, if Chris was here, he would be dying. And if Rachel was here, she'd be loving it. But it's funny how you two are totally different.
Yeah, I hate humidity with a passion.
But so far, everything is going well down here, and it's nice to see Mom and my sister. I'm here mostly so my sister can go on a little vacation with her friend, and that's what they're doing, and I guess she's doing okay. And I'll be in Orlando next week for 3 days of training with some new software that we're considering bringing on board, and then the following week, I'll be back home to hopefully slightly warmer Colorado.
Yeah, it'll be springtime by then.
Well, it'll be close to springtime, but also our snowy season. For those who don't know, the two snowiest months in Colorado are March and April. And it'll dump a ton of snow, but then it'll be 70 degrees the next day and it starts melting. It's the bizarrest thing you've ever seen. Okay, without getting any deeper, so we don't banter back and forth too long, let's get into the first question. And it is a Social Security question, folks. We always like to lead with Social Security question, and then we'll migrate over to more of the questions we have on the fun number. And we have a couple on minimum dignity floor as well. So I figured I'd throw those in today, Chris, and we'll take care of all of it. But this one comes to a listener in Yorktown, Virginia. He does not give a hint question, so that's why I gave you the state. But a couple people today have given you hints, or me hints, to give to you. And we'll go from there. But this begins, Jim and Chris, loved listening to your podcast over the last 3 years. I turned 65 in 2022. I will reach my full retirement age June of 2024. My wife turns 65 in May of 2023 and will reach her full retirement age in January of 2025. Our plan is for her to file for Social Security at her full retirement age based on my earnings record. My question is about the timing of the application for the two of us. Must I physically be receiving benefits before she can apply for spousal benefits? Or can we apply at the same time and Social Security will use my benefit to determine her benefits? If I apply and begin receiving benefits in January 2025 and then she applies, would Social Security calculate any delayed benefits for her? Are there any pitfalls or advantages to the time of year you apply? Say, applying in January versus December.
Okay.
And then finally, he asks, in your experience, how much lead time is needed for the application to start benefits?
Okay, a few things going on there. It is true that in order for his wife to collect spousal benefits, he also must be collecting, but you can file simultaneously. It seems like from his question, he was worried that he'd have to turn his on and maybe get his first deposit into his account before she could even go in and apply. And that's not true. You can go in and file these things simultaneously and they'll see in the system that they're starting together. If you know, sounded like you were actually going to delay past your own full retirement age a little bit. Your full retirement age, you said, was in June of 2024, but then you went on to say that you would, if you begin receiving benefits in January of 2025, which is when your wife turns her full retirement age, you're going to have a little bit of delayed retirement credits for your benefit. But when you ask if you asked if when you apply in January, then she applies, would they calculate a delayed benefit for her? Well, spousal benefits and survivor benefits, when you're receiving them, don't get delayed retirement credits from the person claiming it. You delaying past your full retirement age by some 6 months or so, because like I said, you said you turned full retirement age June of 24, but wouldn't claim until January of 25, your benefit's going to increase about 4% compared to what it would have been if you claimed in June of 24 at your full retirement age. But your wife's benefit is not going to increase, because that's not how delayed retirement credits work. Now, where she will benefit from you delaying a little bit to, 6 months or so past your full retirement age, if you pass away and she then steps into your shoes to collect a survivor benefit, your survivor benefit instead of a spousal benefit, she would benefit from that 6 months worth of delayed retirement credits that you generated by delaying before you claimed your own benefit. So that's where people get confused a lot, is there is a delayed retirement credit component to survivor benefits, but it's only the delayed retirement credits that the original number holder, the original worker, created for themselves before that benefit turned into a survivor benefit for their spouse after the number holder passes away. The person receiving the survivor benefit cannot create additional benefit through delay past their full retirement age. Same thing applies to spousal benefits. Timing-wise, it says, he asks, are there pitfalls to claiming at a particular time of the year? I'd say they're mostly related to if you're going to be affected by the earnings test, right? If you're transitioning from work and then claiming Social Security, there can be reasons to claim at different times related to when you stop working. I'd throw that out there. It doesn't sound like that might be the case here. He didn't mention anything about working. And then also tax-related reasons. It might behoove you to, claim at different times for tax purposes or for qualifying for ACA premium tax credits or things like that, which can occasionally make the case or create a situation where it'd be advantageous to maybe push some income into the next year or something like that. So there can be reasons for around the year, but otherwise, there's not any obvious like, oh, gee, you should always claim and fill in the blank month of the year. There's not really an advantageous month. Always remember, though, that whenever you want to start collecting benefits, you have to have filed for and be claiming the month before, because they pay the benefits 1 month in arrears. So be aware of that when you go in and claim. And then his last thing would be, how much lead time do they need for an application? And guidance is still 3 months, from what I've heard. I haven't heard anything, differently than that. I think you're still pretty safe if you're claiming 3 months prior to you wanting your benefits to begin. And that gives them plenty of time to get everything set up so that you won't have a delay. Now, if you miss that, for instance, he's talking about claiming both he and his spouse claiming in January of 2025, and let's say they forget and they don't go in and claim until, say, December, just the month before that. You can still have them start the benefit in January. You can technically, if you apply in December, you could ask them to start the benefit in December, in the same month that you're applying. It isn't going to happen fast enough for you to get that first payment right away, but they will make it up to you. They will, once everything gets settled in the system and everything is paid out, they'll give you a lump sum, kind of a catch-up payment for any of the months that they missed because of the timing of it. But if you want to avoid that and want things to just work really smoothly, I still recommend you go in 3 months before. So if you wanted to have things starting up in January of 2025, I'd probably apply in October of 2024, telling them very clearly that you want the benefit to start in January of 2025. And that should work just fine. You can also likely accomplish this online through ssa.gov if you've got your account set up. They've been adding functionality in there where you can claim most kinds of benefits now and do practically everything that you could do if you go into a face-to-face meeting with in the local office. So if that's trouble or problematic for you, or your office is still on a big delay to set up appointments and things like that, you know, you might, when October rolls around, just try to file online, see if it works out, and you can specify the month you want it to start and all that. And if you run into any trouble, then there's still time for you to go in and talk to somebody or call somebody on the phone and talk to them. So good questions. I think I tackled everything that they were curious about.
I think you did. All righty. I am just getting some questions pulled up on the screen. We'll start with a non-Social Security. Well, actually, before we get to the non-Social Security question, I did want to point out, we got a shout out from someone who, do you remember when I mentioned dancing with frogs instead of dancing with wolves?
Yes, I do recall that.
You do recall that. Well, someone wanted to point out to us, and I just want everybody to know, and I thank this listener for clearly acknowledging the movie I was most likely thinking of. He said, I'm 18 days behind your podcast, so I just caught up with Jim's recommendation for the movie Dancing with Frogs on the most recent podcast I heard. Amazingly, you can find a hit on YouTube for Dancing with Frogs. It's titled Dancing with Frogs of India. He says, but Kevin Costner is not listed as even a supporting cast member. And although I hope for a gripping Western with shootouts and Western music and rampaging amphibians, I guess the movie on YouTube, Dancing with Frogs of India, did not include any of that. Mm. But clearly there is a Dancing with Frogs movie out there if anybody wants to watch it.
Wow. Put that on my watch list for this weekend.
Well, if it's going to be cold and snowy this weekend, that's what you and Melissa can. How's she feeling, by the way, with her?
She's
COVID
better.
That you
She's
gave
better
her?
Too. She's her loss of taste and smell has lingered longer than mine. She still can't taste or smell really anything, so that's kind of a bummer. But mine came back, so I'm hopeful for her as well. But other than that, she's feeling a lot better. A little bit of lingering stuff, like I think everybody who gets it still has some lingering issues for a while. But she's over the worst of it for sure. She's up and active.
And you probably gave it to her, or did you guys catch it?
I think so. No, I think the timing wise is perfect for me having got it first and then passing it on to her, because she got it, you know, kind of with about a 5-day, 6-day delay. On when I had it, so
you probably got it from CSU. I'm guessing.
I'm guessing it's pretty active over there. Actually, after I got back over there, I found out that there were 3 of us faculty members in the department that all were out simultaneously with it. So, and then things have been pretty quiet with nobody having it for quite some time. So I think I just got caught up in a wave of activity on campus. So it is what it is. Well, luckily everybody that I know of has gotten through it fine lately.
Well, I'm glad you're doing well, and I'm glad Michelle, Melissa is on the mend as well. Okay, that's enough with COVID and Dancing with Frogs. This is a kind of IRA/401k question. A little easy one. It came in this week, folks. I want to kind of get back into the question of the week. And it says, hello, Jim, Chris, Bob, and team. He gives his state. I don't know enough about this state to really say anything. He's got a lot of lakes. How's that?
It's got to be Minnesota.
Minnesota, yep. Okay, we will call him George. He is from Minnesota. He asks, does the IRS keep track of your basis in your 401k and your IRAs? If yes, how do you request this information from them? I moved my after-tax basis from my 401k into my IRA due to limited investment options inside the 401k. But I didn't retain any of the paperwork. I expected that data would be available online. But now I've learned the data is not available because my prior 401k has gone through several custodial changes. So that's his whole question, folks. Let me kind of explain what's going on with him and what he's trying to figure out. I'm guessing quite a while ago, because it said there's been several custodial changes with his prior 401k, but some point in the past, he didn't like the investment options in his 401k. He took the money and he moved it to an IRA. No harm, no foul there. What he should have done when that initially happened was filed Form 8606, establishing to the IRS that some of that money he moved contained basis. He didn't do that. Now, he said he didn't do that because he thought he had access to that basis information online. Even if he did have access to it online, he's still required to file Form 8606. The IRS requires that form be filed to establish basis. But he didn't. Now, fast forward however many years it's been and several custodial changes, I'm under the impression no custodian has any additional information. The current custodian, and I would assume the past custodians, are telling him, we don't have any basis information for you anymore. We don't have that. And he's wondering, does the IRS have it? Does the IRS keep track of it? No, the IRS doesn't keep track of it. They can't. That's why they require you to do it with Form 8606. That's the form you will file which establishes basis. And the IRS gets a copy of that form, and ostensibly they keep a record of that form. Now, if he did file Form 8606, and he never mentioned that he did, I would get a hold of whatever CPA or tax preparer did the taxes for you, or if you did it yourself, go pull up an old copy. And if you have the Form 8606 from when you moved the 401k, no harm, no foul. But my gut tells me none was ever filed. No 8606 was ever filed. So there's no form for you to even look up. Well, the IRS doesn't have any basis in there either. So it's going to be next to impossible for you to try to recreate. What I suggest you do is look through to see if you have any old statement, any old 401k statement that may indicate on it the basis amount, because 401ks generally track that separately. They'll show you your basis on the 401k statement. I don't know, but if you could just find an old one, that would at least help you create basis. You can file Form 8606 and try to guess what your basis is, but I don't recommend that. Because if you all of a sudden file a form 8606 with the IRS that magically says you have X amount of dollars of basis out of the blue, they may ask for proof on that. But it does, Ed Slott has said, it does, filing 8606 at least gets it going in their system, gets the statute of limitations going on it, establishes it in the eyes of the IRS. But if you are ever audited or ever questioned to prove this basis that you're saying automatically just appeared, you have to have ironclad proof. They will not take, that's what I guessed it was, or that's what I think it was. That's not good enough for them. They're going to want some type of proof. And good proof would be a statement from the plan custodian. You may also want to get a hold of the older plan custodians, not necessarily the first person who answers the phone, but ask them to elevate you to perhaps their supervisor and talk to the supervisor to see, even if you have to pay them, can they recreate a history of that, or is all the data lost? And get a hold of the current custodian. They are supposed to receive a copy. Whenever a custodian is changed, folks, the custodian who is being fired, for lack of a better term, must send the new custodian all records. So the old custodian has it. When they quote unquote send it, they still have an electronic copy of it somewhere, but the new custodian should have it as well. You may have to pay them to recreate a history of that holding, but it might be worth it if they have a fee that you can pay and they can go back and pull some old statements or recreate a history. This isn't going to be easy. So the other thing Chris and I often say, look at what the potential dollar amount is. If we're only talking a few thousand dollars, even $5,000, $10,000, $15,000, what you're faced with is having to pay taxes on that money again. And if you actually add up what the taxes on those dollars are probably going to come to, and you look at what it's going to cost in dollars to pay taxes again, it may not be worth your time to do everything and track this all down in an effort to recreate basis.
Right. Especially if you have to pay one of the custodians to do some research.
Yeah, that could diminish the benefit as well. Now, if you're talking hundreds of thousands of dollars of basis, if you were doing massive after-tax contributions of $10,000, $20,000 or more a year, and you did it for 10 or more years, it may be worth it for sure to try to recreate that basis. So sometimes, Chris, people overcomplicate things or worry needlessly over basis in an account. And they either hate it and they want to get it out, or they want to recreate it now to try to save something, I guess. I don't know. But it amounts to only a few thousand dollars, and sometimes it's just not worth it.
Yeah. Yeah, I didn't hear you read like an amount he was estimating it might be. But if it's not very much, it's probably just a lesson to be learned to not forget to file 8606 whenever you do a transaction like this. And also, the bigger lesson we should point out to people is when this was transferred out, that was likely an opportunity to have those dollars put in a Roth IRA. Then you wouldn't have to track this, and the future growth on that basis would be tax-free rather than taxable like it is right now. Having after-tax basis in your IRA doesn't give you future tax-free growth benefits. All the growth is taxable. All that remains untaxed is the basis amount originally it was, and it just sits in there. So we didn't even get into why didn't you split it out and put it in a Roth instead of putting basis into your traditional IRA. That would have avoided this issue as well. And then when Jim unmutes his mic, he'll be back.
Whoops,
to us.
Sorry, I was still talking. I forgot I muted. I can never remember. What I'm getting at again, folks, as we wrap this up, I really encourage this listener to look at the amount of dollars you're talking, figure out or estimate what the overall taxes on those dollars would end up being, and then try to decide if your time is going to be worth what paying taxes on those dollars again would come to. That would be the only caveat. But trying to create it, if you can't get any luck from the custodians, I still would file 8606 if you feel certain you know the basis amount and you can at least come close to explaining to an IRS agent how you came up with it. That at least gets the statute of limitations going and at least establishes basis for that IRA in the IRS's system. And everyone else, take this as a learning lesson. When you move money from a 401k into an IRA and you put after-tax contributions in there, document that basis on Form 8606 right away because you have that info from the custodian. It's there. You just moved the money. The custodian has that info. Get a copy of your statement showing the basis and scan it or take a photo of it and digitalize it. Put it somewhere where it's backed up and you're always going to have it. So if you ever question on how did you file a Form 8606 establishing X amount of dollars as basis in your IRA, you will say, hey, here's how I did it. And here's a copy of the statement from my employer. When I moved it, you can clearly see the employer has indicated what my basis is. And that is why the IRS mandates to employers that they track basis. They don't mandate it to IRAs, but they mandate it to employers to track after-tax basis contributions into those accounts. Okay. So let's get into a couple of questions. This is going to end it with our discussion on the fund number, folks. We got a few more questions in. I'm going to try to answer some of them, maybe all of them if we have an opportunity. But we did get a couple of questions in from people on our fund number. Okay, this one begins, he gives a hint for his state. So you ready for this hint?
I guess, yes.
Okay. This George, we're going to call him George, lives in the state where the frozen margarita machine was invented. And
frozen margarita machine.
And he wrote to us on February 22nd, which is National Margarita Day.
Yeah. I knew that just happened.
How the hell did you know February 22nd was National Margarita Day?
Because I am an enjoyer of margaritas, first of all. So I noticed when that day came around, I missed it because I still wasn't feeling all that great. I'm not doing a lot of drinking yet, so I didn't have a margarita. And I kind of regretted that once I realized it was National Margarita Day. I have a frozen margarita machine from Margaritaville, which sounds kind of like a Key West kind of a deal. So I'm going to say Florida.
I thought that too when I read his email,
Yeah. But
it is a different hot, humid southern state with a very large coastline.
Texas. Yeah. Okay. That was my second
but
guess.
You don't. Well, I guess, yeah, you could see margaritas because of Tex-Mex.
Yeah.
But you think more margaritas as Key West.
That's kind of where I was thinking, but, you know, it's okay. Texas. I've had a lot of nice margaritas in Texas. A lot of good Mexican food to go with it, too.
Anyways, folks, thanks for the question. I like that. That way I can test Chris and either
Plus
make him
we can
a
talk about
brilliant.
Margaritas, yeah.
Well, I'm impressed that you knew February 22nd was National Margarita Day.
Well,
so.
It's not like I know it all the time. I just happened to notice it a couple days ago that I hadn't had a margarita on that day. So,
I give you kudos for even noticing that. All right, here's this question, and it kind of ties into you being the main guy who does the planning. And it does tie into the fund number, but he's looking at it more from the minimum dignity floor, because, you know, in order to get your fund number, folks, you have to first be able to identify your minimum dignity floor. So he begins and he says, in all of your work with clients, have you developed any averages or ranges you can share of what you typically see a couple planning to spend on their minimum dignity floor as well as what the average person spends on fun? I'm not looking for the dollar amounts, but rather a percentage of, it doesn't really say, but rather the percentage. So transportation is typically, and he said hypothetically, 5% of lifetime spending and so on and so on. How would you address, some of that? I know you've given dollars before, but I don't know if we've ever broken it into percentages.
Well, I could convert it to percentages pretty easily. And this is, you know, there's a wide variation around the average. We'll say that. You know, some people, particularly, not so much with the minimum dignity floor. Minimum dignity floor is really based on a couple of key factors. Where you live. And whether you're carrying a mortgage into retirement or not. Those are probably the two biggest factors in the minimum dignity floor. because, you know, as humans, we all kind of keep our houses about the same temperature. So utilities are going to be pretty consistent depending on, you know, whether you have $500,000 or $5 million saved up. That really doesn't change. You eat, you know, from the grocery store, you know, there's a pretty narrow range of budgets for a couple. You know, some variation, but there's a lot of consistency actually in the minimum dignity floor expenses. The fun expenses are all over the board. There are people that are homebodies that just don't spend a whole lot. And there's some people that are active world travelers, which is very, very expensive. And not only do they do it a lot, they do it at kind of higher end resorts and they fly, you know, business class and, or first class. And they, you know, that can be very different. So there is going to be a lot more variation in the fun side of it. But if I was going to kind of describe a typical minimum dignity floor, I think ranges throughout the United States here for most couples between $50,000 and $70,000 a year in today's dollars. That obviously is going to grow over time with inflation. But that's kind of where how we construct the minimum dignity floor. And if you're constructing it differently than we would approach it, of course, that isn't going to apply to you. But I think that's kind of the range of normalcy. If I see it lower than that or higher than that, I start to look and see why. What are the unique factors to make sure there's not a mistake somewhere or something like that. But I think in my mind now, having seen hundreds of these, I think 50 to 70. Then on top of that, I think a pretty typical fund budget for people who aren't necessarily, you know, aren't a homebody and aren't an extreme world traveler, right? Kind of lopping off the extremes there. Maybe, you know, at least during the go-go period, like $40,000 a year, once you put everything in there together from the more mundane things all the way up to some travel and stuff like that. So, you know, if we look at it like that, you're probably looking at somewhere around 65% of your budget, roughly, you know, being minimum dignity floor and 35% of it being fun. But again, that fun can be very different depending on your tastes and your goals and how old you are and how active you are and what hobbies you have. Some people have cheap hobbies, some people have expensive. So the fun is very specific to you. Minimum dignity floor is a little more consistent. But if I, you know, if somebody, you know, forced me to give them an average, I'm not saying this person's forcing me, but I, you know, I think that's about it. You know, 35, 65, something like that.
Okay. Yeah, I totally agree with you. Everyone is different, listener and listeners. And we just don't have enough to be able to say, hey, you should fall within this realm. I think he could create his own as well. I think everybody mm-hmm. could, if you want to break it down into percentages. Perhaps he's wondering if he's spending too much or too little. I think overall, you've said many a times on the podcast that you see typical total dollar amounts for minimum dignity floor. And don't they, for most people, fall somewhere around 50 to 80?
For total what?
For total minimum dignity floor.
Yeah, 50 to 70, which is what I said in my explanation.
50 to 70, okay. Yeah.
Maybe 80, but that starts to get high. And certainly on the higher end would be people that are carrying a mortgage in or live in a particularly expensive area, because part of your minimum dignity floor is going to be things like property taxes and insurance. You know, if you live in Hurricane Alley in Florida and have a really expensive house, even if you don't have a mortgage, your, you know, minimum dignity floor is going to be higher than average because of the property taxes and insurance, HOA fees. I've seen some HOA fees that are very, very high. That has to go into your minimum dignity floor. Other people don't live, you know, they live in a low property tax, low insurance cost, no HOA situation. That obviously would be very different, but that I think that range is for typical, that 50 to 70, 50 to 80 maybe is where we see a lot of people fall.
All righty. Well, I think what we can do is move on to another kind of minimum dignity floorish question since we're on that. And I think we're getting these questions, folks, even though it's tied to the fund number, because in order to calculate your fund number. You really have to go through your minimum dignity floor first: food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare expenses. If this is your first time listening to this Q&A podcast and you have no idea what Chris and I are talking about, go back and listen to our EDU shows. And we did a whole series of EDUs on the minimum dignity floor concept and a whole series of shows on the fund number concept and a whole series of shows on investment management and other things like that that we believe in. But the minimum dignity floor and the fund number series of shows will really help you understand what Chris and I are talking about and what this person is talking about when they're asking about minimum dignity floor. Okay, this person gave you a hint as well, because this one you're going to nail. Although they could, I will accept two states as the answer, because I'm not quite sure what they mean by home state. They live in the state that they claim is the home state of President Biden.
Is he from Vermont?
No. Want to try again? You got 49 left.
Well, he goes, I remember he used to commute back somewhere when he was working. So he wrote, you know, all the stories about him being on the train and everything. Delaware?
Yeah, he's from, he was a senator from Delaware.
There it is.
But he was born in Pennsylvania. He's always talking and bragging in a positive way, not in a negative way, that he was born in Scranton, Pennsylvania. So when she said home state.
So she's talking about Pennsylvania there?
Well, no, she's talking about Delaware. She's from Delaware.
Okay.
And I guess the home state of where he served as senator, but not the home state in the sense of where he was born. That's why I said I would accept two states for the answer. Delaware.
I think Delaware is more his home because that's where he lives. I mean, that's
Vermont was not on the list of acceptable states.
Yeah,
so
I missed
you're 0-2, my man. You're 0-2.
Sorry, I'm doing my best here.
I'll give you the Florida for Margarita, but Vermont. No, you're getting him confused with Bernie Sanders, who's from Vermont. Although I don't know if Sanders was born in Vermont or not, but. He's been serving the fine people of Vermont for Lord knows how long. All right. Again, this is kind of a MDF style, not kind of, it is an MDF style question. Okay. It says, good afternoon, Chris and Jim. Wow, they lead with you. That's a mistake right there.
No, that's proper. It's alphabetical order.
Yeah. Well, it's a big dig. Okay. My hubby is from New England and loves the New England Patriots. Very good. Clearly, they're trying to brown-nose their way into having their question answered. I love your show. It's amazing how much we can learn. I love the in-depth coverage and the banter, which is good because we banter quite a bit. Okay, I have a question on calculating the MDF in the post-delay period when all our secure income is turned on. Do you think we should explain what they're talking about or
real quick. The delay period we refer to is as you're waiting for all of your secure income to be turned on, which for most people means waiting until their Social Security for both of them has been fully engaged. They may have other secure income, but most of the time, if you have a pension or something like that, it's been turned on even before the Social Security starts, or at least simultaneously with it. So the latest of the delay period is usually if someone's delaying their Social Security benefit being turned on. And then at that point, you've got all your secure income. And then the reason that relates to the minimum dignity floor is we propose in our approach that you cover your minimum dignity floor expenses with secure income so you can protect those expenses to the best of your ability from longevity risk. And that's because you're relying on that income that's going to come in forever rather than asset distributions that might not last if things go poorly. So that's why we're relating, they're talking about the post-delay minimum dignity floor. Is my guess is they've got some issue with secure income compared to that.
Okay. And I do want to add, folks, since it just popped into my mind, It's not only longevity risk. Chris is 100% correct. Longevity risk is massively important. But our concept of covering minimum dignity for items, food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare, with lifetime guaranteed income, is to also help guard against other risks you will have in retirement. And two in particular. First, aging-related risk. As you age, you are not going to understand financial concepts as well as you do now. We talk about this a lot. I don't know if we've talked about it lately or if you even mentioned it during the recent fund number series we did. But that is a big thing for Chris and I. We rely heavily on a study from Harvard University that found the average human, there's going to always be tail ends on that bell curve average. There'll be people who start losing their their ability to understand financial concepts far sooner than age 53, which according to Harvard is the age where our brains for most people turn and our ability to understand financial concepts begins to diminish after age 53. There are some people who will lose that or start to lose it before 53, and there are some people who will never lose it. But for the majority of people, the vast majority, as they start aging, their ability to understand financial concepts diminishes. So Chris and I strive for simplicity. And part of covering covering minimum dignity floor with secure income is to keep things simple for the older you. In case the older you does begin to lose their ability to understand financial concepts or their interest. And I've shared countless stories on prior podcasts of clients of ours who tell us eventually they're just not into it anymore, into investing. I've had people who came on board with us who were really into investing and do-it-yourselfers and loved it. And any number of years later, generally speaking, as they start to get deeper into retirement, into their 70s, they're just bored with it. They just don't want to do it anymore. But the whole concept, the whole reason, or not the whole, but one of the reasons we like secure income so much is it's simple for the older you to understand. My Social Security, my pension, if you have one, my income annuity, if you purchased one, all of this income that comes in like a bottomless cup of coffee, it never runs out. It just keeps coming in. All of this steady income coming in, you know, okay, that goes into my checking account and it's going to cover my food, my utilities, my transportation needs, my housing needs, my healthcare needs. My fund spending is over here. It's in other accounts or it's in another bank account, and it's easier for you to understand. Those are my discretionary items, but I have that set. So that's one of the reasons we do it. And the whole concept, I like calling it the bottomless cup of coffee, folks, because it's never ending. You are not going to fear spending those dollars. It just keeps coming back. It's like that candle that people put on there, that trick candle on your birthday cake. You blow it out, it lights again. You blow it out, it lights again. You blow it out, it lights again. You spend this money this month, it's going to be back. You spend it that month, it's going to be back. It just keeps coming. Knowing that you have that steady stream of income overcomes or helps overcome another risk, not only longevity and not only aging, but also the emotional risk of spending money. When you retire, it's going to freak you out. We say that all the time. And you spent your whole lives, you do-it-yourselfers, amassing wealth. You're loath to spend it. And it's going to be a big learning curve for you to actually take money from your savings and spend it. Well, if you knew you had this steady stream of income coming in all the time, not necessarily for fun, but coming in all the time to cover your minimum dignity floor, in theory, we feel it should help make spending your money a little bit emotionally easier. So you feel comfortable spending money, especially in a down market or especially in a bad economy. Because as we readily say, you don't know how long your go-go phase is going to last in retirement. It could be a day, could be just a few more hours, or it might be many, many more years. But that phase of retirement where you have the health, inclination, desire, and ability to go do discretionary fun things, we don't want you freaking out and rationalizing, irrationally rationalizing that, oh, I'm just going to wait another year or two for my portfolio to recover because the market is down, or I don't want to do this year because the economy isn't looking too good. I'm going to put it off. And you do, only to eventually be handed some sort of calamity that derails your ability to go have fun, either outright or have fun at least at the level that you thought you were going to do. So by having that steady stream of income, it should make things easier. So I know I kind of diverged a little there, Chris, but that's typical for me. But I did want to point out, secure income is, yes, a longevity risk, but it can also help with aging risk, and it can also help an aging / cognitive risk, and then also with the emotional risk of spending money. Okay, so they have a question specific. Are you still there, Chris?
I am.
Excellent. Okay. They have a specific question, though, on minimum dignity floor. Maybe you can now take over and answer this. We have no shortfall in our minimum dignity floor until the first spouse passes away. Then I estimate the shortfall will begin at $1,500 a month. I also calculate, and he did what you do all the time, Chris, how does this shortfall increase? The first, he doesn't tell me or us, is this shortfall right now or at some unexplained year in the future? I don't know. I'm going to assume right now. He did a calculation that if one of them dies, the surviving spouse is going to be $1,500 short. And he also calculated, Chris, they need to increase that $1,500 by 8% a year for the rest of their lives. So he says, how do we handle this? Would you suggest we actually reserve funds for this potential minimum dignity floor shortfall in our calculation of the fund number? If yes, what is an overview of how to calculate how much we need to set aside? I know it's $1,500 a month growing at 8%, but how much do I need to set aside? Would you look also at buying an annuity that would cover joint lives now when trying to price out an annuity product? Thank you and your team for all you do.
So this, you know, happens a fair amount of time, and that's one of the reasons why we always look at what we call in the office survivorship scenarios. We don't just look at it with both of you living, you know, deep into retirement, into your 90s or beyond. We look at what happens if one of you passes away much earlier, leaving one spouse on their own for an extended period of time, just kind of stress test in particular for things like minimum dignity floor. You know, obviously the fun becomes less expensive when there's only one of you. So if we've got a successful looking plan as a couple for supporting fun, it's almost guaranteed that you're going to have no problem covering the fund for one person if one person passes. But minimum dignity floor protection, which becomes, I think, even more critical for a survivor, because after the trauma of losing a spouse, having even, you know, that what Jim was referring to, that simplicity of income coming in to cover your most critical expenses reliably, and so you don't have to worry about dealing with at least that part of your life and focus on it because it's kind of more in the automatic phase is very comforting, particularly for a spouse that's lost a spouse, kind of might feel unsettled at that point. So I think it's even more important to be looking at these survivorship scenarios. And he's identified an issue, $1,500 a month shortage after one of them passes, as far as protecting or covering the minimum dignity floor. And as this is typical, that shortage increases over time because most secure income, including Social Security, we don't believe is expected to grow, even if it has an inflation adjustment like Social Security, in alignment with the growth of the minimum dignity floor, because the minimum dignity floor has this healthcare expense as a large component and a few other expenses that have been shown over the past 10, 20 years to be inflating noticeably higher than average inflation. So it's, you know, his number, his 8% is something I see actually all the time. That's a very typical number for the growth in the gap when a gap shows up. So addressing it, the first thing I always look at, this is a financial need caused by the death of a spouse. Maybe there's life insurance that's already in place. Maybe that could provide funding to support this additional need for income and might be worth considering. So I'll put that out there. That's always, you know, whenever death creates a financial need, that's what life insurance was created for. So that's worth considering. But if you have enough other assets where it's really just a matter of preparing for this, you can afford it. You just need to be prepared for it. The way we would propose you prepare is estimate how much you might want to set aside so that you promise each other while you're both alive that, hey, as a couple, we're not going to touch this pool of money here because it's meant to step in and generate more secure income for the surviving spouse after the first of us passes away. And we'll just feel more comfortable in our overall plan knowing this set aside is over there. Then it just comes down to how much is the set aside. Well, you can estimate it. Way we would estimate it is actually go out and get some quotes for the cost of an annuity, a simple income annuity, specifically a SPIA, single premium immediate annuity, that would pay what he's looking to replace, that $1,500 a month growing at 8% every year, so that every year that $1,500 paycheck that happens every month grows by 8% compounded to keep pace with what he expects to see in the behavior of the minimum dignity floor. Then, you know, look at when that might be needed. And you might say, well, it's when they die. We don't know when that is. Well, if that's a shortage that would occur immediately if you were to die tomorrow, then you need that, you know, that amount right away kind of set aside in preparation. So I would set that aside and keep it protected you don't need to pursue a whole lot of growth with it because as you age, the cost for generating the income can decline due to, how annuities are priced. That's driven a lot by your life expectancy. So that's how I'd estimate it. And you can get your own quotes. You can actually pull quotes for simple income annuities. We sometimes put out there immediateannuities.com. That's a public-facing site. We use direct access to real quotes in our office because we have access to them. But if you want to go to immediateannuities.com, that's a good way to get an idea of what an annuity that you're talking about, $1,500 a month, you can enter in your ages or maybe the ages where you might expect that need to occur if it's not for a while. In other words, if you died today, it's not really a problem. Your surviving spouse wouldn't need it for 5 years, even if you were dead now. You could, you know, price it out 5 years from now and then do the proper time value of money adjustments for estimating the set aside today. So you have some flexibility there. And I think the latest version of that website does allow you to get quotes with inflation-adjusted annuities.
See, I was going to ask
years
that,
ago. It didn't, but yeah. I thought I heard from somebody who went there that it now allows you in some kind of advanced tab. So while you maybe say something, I'll go on there and see if they do that, because that's adding an 8% inflation adjustment to the annuity is going to jack up the cost tremendously compared to an annuity that's just flat. So you're going to definitely want to price one out that has that proper inflation adjustment in it. So why don't you
I'll take over and talk a little while you look. I was just on their website not too long ago. I didn't see that ability, but I didn't look closely on it. Again, folks, we have far more professional software that gives us access that actually is probably the same software that powers immediateannuities.com. But you can look through there. Chris will check it out. A few things that I want to mention is, first of all, because I know there's a lot of listeners who hate annuities. Don't lose sight of the point that we're trying to help this person with. They are trying to put their plan together. They have already figured out there's going to be a shortage if one of them, I'm under the impression, if either one of them die early, there is going to be an income shortage. So he's figured out how much that income shortage will be. $1,500 growing at 8%. I have to assume $1,500 in 2023. So next year or 5 years from now, it'll be 8% compounding per year from there as his shortage. So it's a sizable shortage that's going to be needed right away. He simply wants to know, how would we handle this? If he was our client, we would identify what that need is. And if they have enough in assets, we would encourage them to put those dollars aside. We're not going to recommend they actually buy an annuity. We would figure out what an annuity company would want this year if death for one of them happened this year. That's the worst case scenario, death right away. What would we need? And that would be initially the dollars we would put aside. We wouldn't necessarily want to invest those dollars overly aggressive. Chris is correct. We don't really need to take much risk with those dollars at all because the cost of the annuity should drop. Well, and I don't want to necessarily say it's going to drop every year because his income need is actually going to rise also every year. But the cost of the annuity does drop as well, because each year you're closer to death, the cost of the same income stream is less. So in other words, a 75-year-old pays less for $1,500 a month for the rest of their life than a 65-year-old would pay over what a 55-year-old would pay. What I would encourage him to do is put the dollars aside, invest them based on your risk tolerance. Because if death happened right away, which is the riskiest time in this, happened the very next year, I'm assuming there's still going to be ample assets other left assets, in your estate to cover that need. So even if you died at the wrong time when the investment was down 10, 15, 20%, I think there's ample liquidity in the estate. So I would be hesitant to recommend those dollars be held principally protected or with any type of call or a buffer on them. I think they should be invested based on your risk tolerance with a growth tilt, because the hope is you won't need them for a very long time. You'll need them someday, but the hope is you won't need them for a long time. And then I would recommend every 5 years or so, go back and reanalyze and recalculate that need and that number. When we work with people on an ongoing basis in our office, we're going to do that on an annual basis, but that's what we do for a living. If you don't do this for a living and you got other things that you want to worry about, I think doing it every 5 years is fair. It's not as good as every year, but if you were to factor or figure it out every 5 years and then look at the reserve and how it's growing, maybe it's too big. 5 years from now, it had some good, strong growth. And of course, you're 5 years older. And even though your income need is growing at 8% a year from $1,500, maybe you have $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 more in there than you need that the new calculation shows. That will allow you to either keep it there as an extra buffer or remove it and move it to another need. Could be moving it to fund discretionary items or moving it to shore up aging reserve or a guaranteed inheritance or something like that. So that number I would just look at every in your case, every five-ish or so years, and just make sure it's still at a level that could support the surviving spouse if and when death happens. Did you find anything from immediate annuities? Yeah, do they offer
Yeah, they
that?
Do, but only with inflation adjustments up to 5%.
And that's so, what I was going to – sorry, yeah. I didn't mean to interrupt, Chris, mm-hmm. but I wanted to point out to people, most insurance companies only inflate up to 5%.
Right.
The only company – and it's not like you can choose 3.694%. It's going to be 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5. The only company that Chris and I know of that goes up to 10% is New York Life. Now, if immediate annuities is only going up to 5%, perhaps they don't offer New York Life.
That's my guess, is they're not. In none of the quotes I've ever seen from them include New York Life, so they must be choosing not to quote that because they don't want to be connected for whatever reason.
I don't want to read too much into what they do, but if someone needs, if your personal calculations, like he estimates 8% a year, if your personal one comes above 5, it's going to be hard to get that quote unless you go to New York Life agent.
And just so you know, right now, at least for someone who's say 72 years old, since I was on there, I just ran a quick quote. I'm not going to give you the numbers, but the relative numbers are important. 0% inflation versus having the 5% inflation built in, that increases the cost of the annuity by 50%. So it's going to be even higher, maybe 75, 80% higher than a flat annuity to get something like the 8% in there. So just to give you some sense of the difference between them, it's substantial because if you live long enough, that inflation becomes very expensive for them to pay you.
But keep in mind, listeners, Chris and I are not advocating you run out and buy this annuity.
Right.
We are advocating your responsibility, which is to make sure there's enough of a reserve and not to spend it on fun, because you can only spend a dollar once. And if you spend it on fun and then expose the surviving spouse to a weakness, that's not fair. It's not fair to the surviving spouse. In order for us, we feel there's no better place to go than to an insurance company actuary who spends their entire lives crunching these numbers. So that's why we rely on an annuity quote. But we're not saying to run out and buy the annuity.
Right.
We're saying that's how much money you need to reserve. The decision to buy the annuity is going to be up to the older you. In this particular case, it's going to be up to an older surviving spouse. Maybe that surviving spouse has sadly been diagnosed with a condition that only gives them a few years to live. There's no need for an annuity at that point, but at least the money was reserved. Or maybe the older spouse, if death happens for one of the spouses early, 2, 3, 4 years into retirement, it happens unexpectedly. Now that surviving spouse is at least assured the ability, if they want, to buy the annuity. The decision isn't yours to make. It's the older you, and in this particular scenario, it's the older surviving spouse, be it the husband or the wife. Your responsibility now is to leave a reasonable amount of money off to the side that accurately reflects the inherent risk of trying to provide $1,500 a month growing at 8% compounded a year. Well, there's no better place to get that. You can write spreadsheets and crunch Monte Carlo scenarios. Why? There are insurance actuaries who did that already and priced it into their product. So just get the quote and make this easier. Now, for all you VG engineer types out there who love writing spreadsheets and geeking out on this, sure, you can write your own spreadsheet and try to figure out based on this return and this correlation and this volatility. And if I die at this point or that point, or if it's me who dies and my wife who dies and I die in an up market or a down market, all the variables that you want to enter in there and you want to write a spreadsheet for it, go ahead. But for those of you who want to try to keep this simple and accurate and not spend money on discretionary fund that you might need later, especially for minimum dignity floor. Chris and I feel, again, minimum dignity floor expenses are non-negotiable. If you're going to borrow my seesaw analogy, the older you is up, the younger you is down on that seesaw when it comes to minimum dignity floor. You must promise explicitly that the older you will be taken care of. So that's why we like to simply go and get these style quotes. And if your growth rate on your potential shortage, be it as a couple during your post-delay period or as a widow-widower after the death of the first spouse, is greater than 5%, to get an accurate quote, you'll have to get a hold of New York Life. I don't know if New York Life's website, maybe they do. I would imagine they do, but they're probably going to force you to put all your contact info in there so one of their agents can call you. But if not, get a hold of a New York Life agent and just tell them, hey, I kind of want this annuity quote. You might be peppered to buy one or buy something else, but we can have access to it through the software that we have, and we help our clients with that. You do-it-yourselfers are going to be in a little more of a bind. I don't know if New York Life's website does it, but I know their agents would be happy to get it for you. And the cost of the quote will probably be dealing with some sales pitch. But few companies offer inflation adjustments because it is so incredibly difficult to do. Well, if it's difficult for an insurance company to do, what makes you think you're going to be able to do it better? These companies are professionals and they do this 24/7. So rely on a good, accurate quote or write a damn good spreadsheet if you're going to try to figure this out yourself and reserve those dollars. That would be how we would handle this particular case.
Right.
He's almost there, Chris. He almost has everything figured out.
Yep. Perfect. That's probably a wrap for here because we're getting into the extra long walking time.
Okay.
For our exercising listeners.
Well, I liked this hint for this next question. Okay, we'll have to hold off.
If it was short, then you promised me it was short, we could do it.
No, this one we could probably opine on for a good 10 minutes.
We can start with that one next time.
Okay, this will be the last one that I know of that we have to cover on this. So hopefully everybody enjoyed the fun number series of EDUs and Q&A shows. But I know I did. I enjoyed teaching everybody about it. And next week on the EDU show, so in a couple more days, Chris will be alone doing it. I think he's going to do it on Social Security. Yours truly will be in Orlando on a little seminar that I'll be attending, learning some new software that the firm is bringing on board. So do you want to let anyone know, Chris, what you're going to talk about?
Not fully decided yet, but probably Social Security focused on there. Get kind of clean up a few things that have been, a few loose ends that have been out there that maybe require a bit of explanation surrounding them. But Jim's promise from the last show about doing the Ed Slott questions, et cetera, will have to be delayed for a week because he is not available this coming EDU recording day. So, but I'll try to dig up some interesting stuff about Social Security that people who are curious about Social Security will enjoy.
All righty, folks. Well, it's a pleasure chatting with everybody from sunny and quite warm Florida. And we'll be back with you next week. And thanks, Chris. Nice chatting again.
Yeah, thanks. Talk soon.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Saulnier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Saulnier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.